its current state on 90.5 WKAR and WKAR.org. On a block in Detroit's East English Village, Cheryl English's front yard sticks out like a green thumb. Her front yard, and for that matter her backyard, are masterpieces of gardening. Many of the plants she used to paint this picture are native to Michigan. She chose them not only because of their beauty, but because native plants are a crucial part of Michigan ecosystems and have many environmental benefits. Current State's Emmanuel Berry joined English Inner Garden, where she explained why people don't always appreciate native plants.
Our traditional garden choices are really driven by where we came from and not where we live. And by where we came from, I mean where the culture came from. And the culture basically came with, starting with Christopher Columbus in 1492, and what was the European invasion. And the European invasion included things like our livestock, our companion animals, our garden plants, our agricultural plants, our diseases, and just our cultural preconceptions of things, of how things should be. We came here to the Americas, and things were different. They weren't the way they were where we came from, and we set out to fix it because it wasn't right based on our experience and our context. And part of that had to do with the landscape, and the plants were not plants we recognized, and they interfered with what we were trying to do in terms of growing crops or what have you. What we have begun to learn recently, and it seems to be snowballing more and more, is that if we want to maintain the native populations of our songbirds, for example, or our pollinating insects like our monarch butterflies and our swallowtail butterflies, we need to have the native plants. And if we don't have them, we're going to lose that part of what we treasure here.
What are some of the other consequences of losing native plants, of not having native plants in gardens and spaces?
I don't know that we can even begin to understand what those consequences might be. I think about the first huge arboricultural disaster in the Americas, in North America, which was the chestnut blight coming in and devastating the American chestnut population. When Christopher Columbus landed in 1492, one out of every four trees in the eastern half of the U.S. was an American chestnut. And the chestnut blight wiped out 90% of them. We, in our ignorance, decided that the blight was going to kill every chestnut, so we clear-cut them out, not realizing that there might have been pockets of genetic resistance to this blight. And we have actually discovered remnant populations that have had a higher degree of resistance, and we are now working with those populations to come up with, through breeding, a plant that can resist the blight. But when we lost the chestnut, we didn't even know what insects might be dependent on that tree, and we didn't even know what was out there. We don't even know what we lost when we lost that tree. We lost an entire chunk of our food web here, and we never even knew what it was. We make decisions with blinders on about our gardens, about our lives, without really realizing, and this is not a criticism, it's just a fact of human behavior, without really thinking about what the consequences might be on the wider environment. One of the things I share with groups that I speak to is the decisions we make on our gardens have consequences far beyond our fence lines. So as to what we're going to lose, if we continue to bring in indiscriminately exotic plants for agricultural or ornamental purposes, we continue to run the risk of bringing along diseases and pests which will continue to devastate our native plants, such as the anthracnose that devastates our dogwoods, the emerald ash borer, the Dutch elm disease. And we are going to end up, if we extend this to its logical conclusion, we will have a global ecosystem which will be made up of a specific limited number of species. There will be extremely limited diversity. We will lose huge chunks of our insect life, probably most of our insect life, and huge chunks of every other part of our environmental part of the food web. We don't even know what we're going to lose. We can't even begin to capture, envision it, realize it.
So here in Michigan, Michigan native plants have why are they better suited, I guess, to this environment and dealing with everything that Michigan weather and the state throws at it?
That's a great question, because a lot of people who grow up or spend the vast portion of their lives here don't realize, it doesn't even occur to them that we live in an environment with extreme weather. We can span 100 degrees Fahrenheit in 12 months here in Michigan, and that is not really the case anywhere else. You know, you don't get that in Florida. You don't get that in California, for sure. We have extreme weather, and the plants that evolved here, even though they may be the same species in other parts of the country, because there's some of these plants have very wide ranges, they are specifically adapted, and they have some genetic distinctions from their cousins from elsewhere. They evolved here. They evolved to accommodate the soil conditions. They evolved to accommodate the climatic conditions. You know, we always have a drought in July and August. And there are plants that really languish in the drought, and a lot of them are exotics. And there are plants that laugh at a drought, like my cup plant, which is 9.5 feet tall when there's a drought and 10 feet when it isn't. One of the reasons I've keep doing more and more with natives is because I don't have to work as hard. And contrary to some people's perception, I actually find the natives much more beautiful because they're so varied. My maintenance in my garden every year is less and less as my natives thrive. I don't use any chemicals whatsoever, either fertilizers, you know, growth enhancers, or pesticides, you know, to suppress weeds or anything. I don't use any chemicals. I use no power tools. And I get to spend more time enjoying my garden and watching the hummingbirds and the butterflies and the goldfinches and hearing the spring peepers.
Well, we're in your big, beautiful garden, so let's take a look at a couple of native plants.
This is cup plant, and you can see it's got a lot of insect larvae, nymphs on there, and I've got a lot of people who are concerned about that. I don't know what they are, but I know that if they're beneficial, I don't care about it. And if they're not beneficial, a beneficial will come along to feed on them. So Mother Nature will keep everything in check. Cup plant is in the Silphium family. It's called Silphium perfoliatum. Perfoliatum refers to the fact that the stems, which are square in section, pierce the paired leaves. And the leaves are always arranged at 90 degrees to the pear below and above them. And the reason for this is that when it rains, the water spills like a big fountain down the plant. And that water that's cupped by the perforated leaves is then there for the larger insects to drink. It also traps younger insects to feed the plant. It also provides water for some of our birds as well. It gets small yellow flowers at the very top of the plant, and you get a lot of nectaring insects on there. You get a lot of birds feeding on the seed. You get squirrels jumping all over it like it's a jungle gym in August to get the seed as well. So this is a plant that really gives up a lot for the wildlife. And it's a plant that can shake off a drought. The roots go down way into the soil. So even if we have a severe drought as we did in 2012, it just laughs it off.
All right, where to next?
The thing about native plants is you often can find a native equivalent to something that you're already growing in your garden that's an exotic traditional garden plant. For example, you have your oriental poppies. Well, we have what we call a celandine poppy, which is a spring flowering poppy with beautiful yellow flowers. We have one of the more popular summer garden plants is the lily family, our oriental and Asiatic lilies. But we have a lily here in Michigan. It's not just endemic to Michigan. It does live in other parts of the Midwest, but it is called the Michigan lily. And it's a beautiful Turk's cap type lily, brilliant deep orange, and the little stamens look like little ballet shoes hanging down. And it's an absolutely to die for plant. It's a spotlight wherever it grows. It can get up to 6 feet tall if it's happy. It does like wetter conditions. And it is an absolute showstopper. The plants that I have in my garden are actually plants that I inherited when my mother passed away. So aside from their value to me as native plants, they also have a very profound sentimental value, and I treasure them.
Are there any plants that are native to Michigan that people would be surprised are a native plant here?
I would say probably the most surprising plant in my garden that people they're always amazed that it's a native plant is the prickly pear cactus. And it is a true cactus. It's a really interesting plant because when fall comes, the pads sort of deflate and they get very sad and they sort of repose on the ground and you pray for snow because it looks like a corpse and you want to cover it up. And then comes spring, it just sort of re-inflates itself. It has these beautiful yellow flowers with orange throats that last, each flower lasts less than a day. And it's really something special, really special.
Yeah, I never would have thought that Michigan has cactuses. That's for sure. So in gardening, there's kind of an entire industry, magazines built off of, as you mentioned, you know, what's new in this philosophy, what's hot, what's coming out. Do you think there needs to be a kind of a paradigm shift in the way people think about gardening?
I think we're going to be seeing a paradigm shift. I know of people who have canceled subscriptions to gardening magazines because they don't carry information on natives. I am seeing more awareness of natives. I do realize that my perspective is rather parochial, you know, informed by my own experiences and my own interests and values. But I think that that is becoming more part of the general consciousness. More people are asking questions and wondering, well, what's the difference? There are a lot of preconceptions about native plants that I fight with. Even when I was working with the Greening of Detroit on their trees committee and we were selecting plants for our tree sale, and I was always the proponent for including some natives, and the response I always got is, well, no one knows what to do with them. And my response to that is, isn't that part of our mission is to educate people about these things? And when you start talking to folks about, well, if you grow common milkweed, you'll get monarch butterflies, and if you grow spice bush, you could get spice bush swallowtail butterfly, and if you grow this plant, you'll get this butterfly. It's really amazing. The eyes light up. People are beginning to realize that the environment has changed. They are seeing fewer butterflies. They are seeing fewer of the big bumblebees. They're seeing fewer blue jays or cardinals. And they're not happy about that. And if we want to repair that damage, or at least stop the trend, if we can't reverse it, at least stop it, native plants are critical to accomplishing that end.
Cheryl English is a master gardener. She lives and gardens in Detroit's East English Village. Cheryl, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
And if you'd like to see photos of Cheryl English's Detroit garden creations and all those native Michigan plants, visit our website, WKAR.org. Click on Current State. This Current State environmental segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news on the Great Lakes environment is available at GreatLakesEcho.org.